Thanks, Dottie. Thanks for the opportunity to talk, and thank you for coming out. I know it's a busy seminar season, so I appreciate you being here. So I'm going to do the classic thing that you're never supposed to do in a talk, and that is talk about two talks rather than one. So at the risk of losing the one message, I'm going to try and tell you two. And so if you lose everything at the very end, I'll remind you what they were, but you know, tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. So to set it up, let me kind of come back. It's a, the theme will be naturalness issues. And you know, we've been on a 20 or 30 year, depending on how you count it, odyssey in particle physics and cosmology based on naturalness, an odyssey of hope and change based on naturalness. And we've been told, and we've been led to believe, and many of us think that that naturalness is useful because it's telling us we should be seeing things. And among the things we could likely have been seeing are supersymmetric particles at the LHC, and inflation could have had some interesting complexity to it. Be worth looking for that. And so that hasn't turned out so well. And so the stop is the supersymmetric partner of the top quark, and the joke is that the only one that's been seen at CERN is this one here. This is the main gate of CERN. And cosmology is simple. You know, the Planck data came in, and it just looks vanilla, single field models. And then the other naturalness issue that people always worry about is the cosmological constant. And not a lot going on there. So since we've been in this odyssey of hope and change, you might ask, you know, how's that hopey changey thing working out for you? As has been asked by a luminary. And so I want to argue with this talk that that it's you can see naturalness. It's right there next to Alaska. You can see it from her house. It's just not maybe the way we expected to see it. So I want to tell you that in two steps. So that's the two parts of the talk. So the acceleration then is the inflation side. And it's a summary essentially of this paper here. And I want to tell you here my pitch as to what I think we're learning from Planck, and also learning from attempts to embed cosmology at that epoch into an ultraviolet completion. And I want to argue for you that many of the questions that you ask about cosmology, be it inflation or be it bouncing cosmologies, whatever it is that's giving you these primordial fluctuations that you see in the CMB, most of the questions that you ask about that physics take you towards the ultraviolet completion, and there's information in that is a part of my pitch. So I want to start with things in which we can all agree. And so that'll be the first part. And then I want to summarize in a particular way what the data likes. And here I'll describe other people's work, but it's going to, I'm describing other people's work because it's going to give you a message which reinforces the pitch I'd like to give you anyway. And so I'll tell you what that was, what the features are of the models that describe the Planck data well. And the short version is that there is a class of models that make progress on the eta problem, if you're an inflationary cosmologist. And then I want to tell you what the sense to which those things that the data likes, how likely are they to come from ultraviolet physics? And so I think that there's a statement that can be made there, or there seems to be a statement that's starting to be made, and that's where I'll close off that section. The second part of the talk is the acceleration now, and that's the dark energy story. And I kind of mocked the cosmological constant problem as being depressing because normally people start off thinking it's a problem that you'd like to solve, and then people despair because there's no solutions to it. And so many of you will know that there's a bunch of us that are embarked on a heroic, epic journey to try and solve the problem. And I think we've solved the technical problem of finding a technically natural cosmological constant. Whether nature cares is a different question, but I think I think it's a high bar to establish that you've solved this problem. But I think that there's a high bar of to convince other people. I want to tell you essentially the two things with the second part of the talk. And one is that because I was talking about the first part doesn't mean that we've given up on the second part, so it's still going fine. So it's not like it's dead. But also I want to tell you something that Matt Williams, who you'll know here, basically found. And it's essentially the mechanism whereby this approach we have seems to be succeeding. And so what's useful about the mechanism, phrasing it as a symmetry mechanism, is that gives you some sense as to whether or not whatever the ultraviolet physics is in the problem can satisfy it or not. And it also gives you an idea of, or a fairly robust idea as to how big the vacuum energy should be, because it tells you what the small parameters are that it has to depend on. And so there'll be some order one factor up front, but you could, the problem until now has always been that the, once you've got all the factors that had to be there, it didn't matter what the order one factor was unless it was 10 to the minus 50 or something. And I'll show you that the order one factors can be 6 million, and it's still gonna, not going to be a problem, I think, for these models. So that's the first part is my day job, and the second part is my true love. And so, so let's start off with the inflationary story. So this is what I told you I was going to break it up, and so let's start with what people would agree on. And so there's four things I think we would all agree on. And one is that the data is driving it, and it's beautiful. Second is that it's the simplest way to accommodate it is some sort of an acceleration in the universal expansion. Now, whether that's a bounce.
So I think that first one is just from other theories to say, I would say the data is absolute.
I guess beauty is in the eye of the beholder at some level. I'm going to actually.
They only show you the beautiful part of it.
Well, and of course they would, right? It's the lingerie effect, right? You show it all, it's ugly, but if you tease people, then it's beautiful. And I'm glad you raised that point because I'm going to come to simplicity. The simplicity story is, I think we all agree simplicity is good, but again, simplicity, what is simple is also a little bit in the eye of the beholder, and I'm going to talk about two kinds of simplicity and contrast them. And so there's some complexity, I think, in the analysis of the data that is a good thing, but that requires some convincing, I think, so I want to make that case. The thing I wanted to finish saying here was that when I say expansion is accelerated, I don't necessarily mean inflation. You know, the bounce cosmologies are also accelerated. The argument is whether or not you're starting from a collapsing universe and accelerating to an expanding one, or you were already expanding and you're now expanding faster. But people tend to be agreeing that there's acceleration going on. And the last thing I want to argue is that, given the discussion of simplicity, that the problems in these models, the devil's in the detail for these models, for no matter how you approach the acceleration, and so the devil in the details takes you towards the ultraviolet completions and necessarily to some complexity. But it's instructive complexity is where I'd like to go. So there is the beautiful data, and that's about all I'll say about it. What you're seeing, though, is correlations and correlations on scales that are larger than the Hubble size, and that's the problem. So the problem is, you know, if you look at predicting what you see for those primordial fluctuations, you look into the past, if you plot size against time on a log scale, so everybody's a straight line if you're a power law. And the basic problem with FRW cosmologies is that the size of the universe is growing, but the Hubble radius is growing faster. And so since the causal mechanisms you'd have for describing the primordial fluctuations have to take place on distances smaller than the Hubble scale, things that are smaller now, where physical processes can be processing things, if you've run them back into the past, they were once larger than the Hubble scale, and then it's difficult to see how you can explain correlations on long distances through physics in the past, given that it's taking place on distances longer than the Hubble scale. And that's more or less the problem everybody's beating on. And of course, the solution everybody uses, the loophole through which people try and find a solution, is maybe that extrapolation into the past isn't a straight line. And so the bouncing extrapolation would have been something like this, but by having the universe shrink and then grow again, you can envision a time in the past when scales inside the horizon now were inside the horizon in the past, and then you can dream up some sort of a scale invariant physical causal process that will give you what you see. And then the inflationary story is a similar one, but it's also getting, it's a bit based on the fact that if you have an accelerated expansion, the universe is expanding faster than the Hubble scale is. And in exponential inflation, the Hubble scale is not expanding at all. So it's the same kind of idea. And then, of course, the problems in both those pictures are to do with the change. In the bouncing case, how do you understand in a controlled way what's going on at the bounce? Why should things bounce? And when can they bounce? And in the inflationary story, the question is, why does inflation ever stop? How do you start it in the first place? Things like that. And inflation has the additional story, or any kind of a cosmology with a complex landscape has the story even if things do stop here, why do they stop everywhere? And if they don't stop everywhere, how do you calculate anything? And I'm going to have nothing to say about this problem, except that it's really a problem for everybody and not just for the inflation people, because no matter how you like your cosmology in one part of the universe, this kind of the problem with the multiverse is not so much that you have to like inflation to have the problem, it's that if anywhere in the landscape there's a multiverse going on, and things are inflating, then that's giving you a problem in how you make predictions. Anybody with a landscape. So if somebody gives you a quantum theory of gravity without a lot of solutions, they'll have made progress. But when that happens, we can worry about it. And I should say, I'm glad you asked that, because I haven't got no axe to grind about string theory here. I'm going to use string theory as my archetype of a UV completion, just because you can be very concrete. It's a very well worked out, explicit theory of what could be going on in the ultraviolet, and you can ask questions in a very crisp and focused way. And it may not be the way nature works, but it's our one crisp place in which we can really ask the questions in a focused way. So, and I'm happy to do it in other ways. If someone gives me a theory B, I'll use theory B. I have no commitment to it at all. All right, so what about the simplicity story? So the simplicity story is that everybody agrees simplicity is good. You're trying to describe that simplest model that describes what you see is what you should want. But there's two senses of simplicity that are going to come up, and that do come up, which I want to distinguish. And the picture is supposed to illustrate it, because it's a picture of a crosswalk in Cambridge, and it's supposed to illustrate how North Americans and the British are separated by common language, and that for them, a humped zebra crossing, as you many of you will know, is a crosswalk with a speed bump in it, and in North America it means something different. So that's supposed to be representative of a similar language difficulty, and that's between cosmologists and particle physicists, and that's part of the story of the simplicity. So I think that the simplicity as a cosmologist, or most cosmologists would traditionally approach it, would be, what's the simplest model you need to describe the data? And you complicate the model to the extent that the data forces you to complicate it. And so if you have data that's described by a simple model, then the world is simple. And that's a very appealing point of view, and I'm not going to argue against that point of view in general. But there's a different kind of a question which raises a different kind of a simplicity issues, which is the particle physics way of approaching the same kinds of physics. And it starts from the observation that in cosmology, like in particle physics, we're, at least right now in particle physics, we're looking at the low energy limit of something. And the question is, what's that low energy limit? And the recognition is that once you're looking at the low energy limit of something, low energy limits can be complicated. They can be messy. They're not the essence of what's making the full theory beautiful needn't be obvious at low energies, and that's why it takes time to discover often what's beautiful about a theory. And so if you're looking at the low energy limit of something, you're instead led to ask questions like, what kind of physics is generic of low energy limits? Because low energy limits tend to be, once you've integrated out the physics of smaller distances, special arrangements amongst coupling constants are often destroyed. And so you typically find in the low energy limit of systems, of which we have zillions to study in nature, that they are the physics that robustly emerges is stuff which is robust to the particle content and symmetries of the problem. And so you're asking kind of what things are generic given the particle degrees of freedom that you have in your problem. And that's not necessarily the same thing as what's the simplest model that the data needs. And so the two ways of talking about inflation or bouncing cosmologies or whatever are to do with that low energy limit story. And I'm emphasizing this because I want to argue that although you can make simple models that describe the data, everybody would agree that all the models on the table that are simple have conceptual difficulties, because the devil's in the details of making these models in detail. And it's the resolving of those difficulties that always force you to the issue of what's going on at higher energies and force you into complexity. And that could come to you in an inflationary context if you're asking, how do you solve the initial condition problem in inflation, or how do you control theoretical uncertainties to do with transplanking physics during inflation, or if you're like bouncing cosmologies, it would be to do with what controls the bounce. All those things are going to be done in a context where you understand what higher energy physics is implying for what you're trying to do with cosmology. Bayes is going to come in shortly. Okay, yeah, I will bring in Bayes. That's in a very particular sense, because Bayes, I think, is more than simple. Bayes is simple in the sense of this simple.
Well, Occam's like, what's the simplest model, and Bayes is what's the simplest model for that debate. The second part.
Yeah. So. it's a, again, a question of how you implement simple. Yeah, but I agree with you. I'm not going to resist you on Bayes should be brought in. Standard, the particle physics has kind of got lots of examples of this. You know, when you look for dark matter, you're not necessarily looking for one particle that could be dark matter, although you can look for that. And there's some classic papers that have been written on that. But you know, you look for things that are natural in the sense that they are stable against changes to microscopic physics. All right. So all these things, I've said this already, the things you're looking for that you don't like about models tend to have as their, if the question can be posed and potentially answered typically only in an ultraviolet completion. And that forces you into this Wilsonian picture where simplicity is to do with what fits into a sensible kind of microscopic physics. And you can kind of take your favorite question and ask how you'd solve it, and you're inevitably led to that kind of a microscopic picture. All right, enough about that. So now what's the data like? And this is where Bayes is going to come in. So here's the picture that they always show you, the Planck data. Here's the tensor to scalar ratio on the side, which is, you know, you have a scalar spectrum of scalar perturbations that your theory predicts, your early universe theory predicts, and you've got a spectrum of tensor perturbations. And R, the ratio of the amplitude of those two things, is what's being graphed vertically. And then the tilt, NS minus NS, is being plotted across the bottom. And you love to live in this oval. And they've helpfully drawn some various models. And they have little ranges associated with the parameters in the model. And you can kind of see who lives in that region and who doesn't live in that region. And that's how they're going to distinguish whether a model is attractive or not. And normally you would have said for simple models, and the data loves simple models, the Planck data, is that if you have a single field slow roll model of inflation, that's a very simple kind of a model. It's a classical framework, and you can analyze things in a kind of a straightforward way. There are two parameters in your problem, which are these two derivatives of the potential. The potential is the thing you get to choose if you have a single field. Modulo a few things you could do in addition to the potential, but generically, most models, it's the potential that you're using. And those two numbers are essentially the things that give you these two numbers that are being plotted in the observational plot. And so depending on how you design your potential, you can put yourself where you want to be. And people have prejudices as to what the potential should be, and that gives them prejudices for what the epsilons and betas are, and that gives them prejudices as where you should be in the plane. But at some level, though, you're learning about two derivatives of your potential if you're doing single field models. So you could ask, is there a way of quantifying what's nice about models? So are there any classes of any kinds of potentials that are particularly attractive from the point of view of the data? And that's what these people, Jerome Martin and his collaborators, did this year. So they made an encyclopedic list of models. And this is only part of their list. And I'm just showing it to you because to emphasize there's a lot of them. And there's some here that are going to be playing a role later on again. And in particular, the first one is HI, which means Higgs inflation. And they chose that as the benchmark model against which to compare everything else, just because there are no parameters in that model. The idea there is you need a scalar field to get inflation. But the standard model needs a scalar field too. And if the particle associated with it has just been found, use that for inflation. Then all the things in the potential that you would be adjusting to make things work are pinned down. There's one thing you get to adjust to get cosmology to work even grossly, and once you've done that, everything's fixed. So that was their benchmark model, and then they asked.
So that coefficient is 1/5 what you
did that? You've got good eyes if you can read that. So they've written a potential here, which is m⁴ 1 minus e to the minus root 2 over 3, square root of 2/3, phi over m Planck. What they really did is they took the standard model essentially and they added a Higgs curvature term with a parameter in front of it. And then they've gone to the Einstein frame and this is the potential you would have had in the Einstein frame. So and that parameter is the one they adjust to make the amplitude of fluctuations basically right. But and I guess the point of the exercise is that once you fix that, the thing you're fixing with that parameter is not the two things that you're being plotted on that graph. And so the idea is that for those two variables, R and NS, that was a parameter-free prediction. And then these other models have parameters in their potential which you can use to dial what you predict for those two quantities.
Is there a reason that there's no fourth power of
these? In front of the curvature term, you mean? Well, so there's in principle, no. There's a mud fight you can have about whether these are reasonable models, which I'm not even going to get into. But it's there is an issue. So the flatness of this potential relies on it as just being H dagger H curvature, and your potential being quartic, the standard model one that stops at quartic. And it relies on that because in the end of the day, for large fields is where that potential is flat. And it turns out that that's the ratio of the potential at large fields divided by the square of the coefficient of the Einstein term. So the fact that you've got phi to the fourth or h to the fourth in the potential and h squared in the Einstein term, that ratio is a constant for large h with those choices, but not with different choices.
So have you changed your mind about this? I remember you were critical.
I'm still critical, but I think that it's true that the issues that we had raised in the past are issues that they have since had to look at, and so that was good. But I think they're right in that there was a very specific, there are many ways, many things you might not like about these models, one of which is not a problem, although it's just marginally not a problem, and that was the issue of, is it self-consistent to talk about inflation at that scale? Is that consistent with the low-energy classical approximation? And they're, I think, right that it's not crazy to talk about it in the sense that so for those of you that were following that, if you take the interactions at small fields and you ask kind of what's the point at which, because it's a non-renormalizable theory because it's got gravity in it, where does semi-classical reasoning break down? You're led to a scale which is suppressed compared to the Planck scale by some power of this coupling between the Higgs and the curvature. And that was the same scale that was the Hubble scale during inflation. And if that was really true that you needed both those things to be the same, that would be inconsistent because you're using classical reasoning to infer that inflation happened, but applying it at a place where classical reasoning should be failing. And the point that they made correctly, I think, is that the scale at which the semi-classical reasoning fails is a function of the Higgs field. And so as you go out to larger values of the Higgs field, because the potential is flattening off, the condition gets weaker because the interactions are getting weaker. And so the scale at which things fail goes up by parametrically. Instead of being suppressed by the coupling, it's suppressed by the square root of the coupling, which is a large coupling. And so if you kind of work out the quantum corrections, they're just, you know, the loops are smaller than the classical predictions. If there had been no four pi's in the problem, they would have been the same size, but the four pi's make it work. So it's just kind of just works. But it's not crazy. So that could be the way that nature works. But it doesn't mean that they're reasonable models. I think if you ask, do I know of any examples of physics at higher energies that gives those models, I'd say no, because the argument for keeping quadratic H in the coupling to the curvature and quartic H in the potential would be scale invariance, say. But normally you think of the potential in the Higgs, for the Higgs as being kind of a Taylor series in H, and you stopped at quartic because those are the first ones you hit. And there's no fundamental reason why things should be scale invariant at higher energies. And so the trick you'd have to have for an ultraviolet completion is something which you integrate it out, and you don't get all the possible things you could have gotten. You, for some reason, just get scale invariant physics at that point. And no one, I think, knows of any examples of physics that do that. That doesn't mean it can't exist, but I think it's true that if you kind of took bets, it's not the kind of thing that you're expecting. It's not easy to do with what we know now. Yeah.
Some eminent cosmologists complain that it's hard to get inflation going.
Yep.
Some claim it's exponentially difficult to get going.
That's the initial condition problem, right? Yes. That was one of the ones I alluded to a couple slides ago.
What is your opinion?
I think that that whole list I showed you, that's one of the things on that list, and there's more things. And I would say that it's open still. I think that in any model you like, you have to ask that question, but to answer that question, you're forced to go to an ultraviolet completion. Because inflation, for example, if you're asking the initial condition problem, you're asking about what happened before inflation, say. So you're at even higher energies. And so then you need to be working in the theory that describes those higher energies. And so I guess the thing I would, to make it as inflammatory as possible, I'd say that nobody who criticizes anybody else's models is allowed to use simplicity as the criterion where they write down a simple single field model. Because when you criticize the other people about what's wrong with their theory, they answer it by going into a complex ultraviolet completion. But the same thing's true about the things that are wrong with your model. And so everybody's forced into the ultraviolet completion, so everybody's really forced to deal with this issue of the complexity associated with embedding things into the ultraviolet completion.
Also, half-life square runs away. And then, this causes a non-uniformity to increase. This is part of the chaotic.
If you wanted to do phi squared, we were talking about potential being phi squared.
The 1/2 phi dot squared is not less than V of phi. It runs away, so you get a non-uniform.
Right. So you can go through your list of inflationary models and you ask these questions. And there's always a question like this. And I would think I think your broader point is that there's no one model which nails it all. And I think that's true. All right. So there's a lot of models. And there, many of them can be distinguished by their potentials. And you might have thought, well, so there's only two numbers you're comparing to. It doesn't really tell you much. And this is where Bayes steps in. And actually, so what the Martin company did was they treated this as a hypothesis testing problem. You've got a lot of things to compare. You've got some data. You can ask which one does a better job. And their benchmark will be they'll compare the likelihood of all these various models to the top one because it has no parameters. And so so this is what they find. So this is they looked at a lot of models. And you can't see the details here. But the main thing to see is that in all these plots, they're looking at the likelihood ratio, if you like, where they're comparing it to the likelihood of this Higgs inflation model. And then here, you're seeing the logarithm. And you can't read it probably, but this is 3, 2, I can't even read it. It's the 9, 9, 7, 5. These are odd numbers. Yeah, so 3, 1, -1, -3, -5. So basically, 0 is where they're equally likely. And the theme you see here, and the colors are just to do with some classification scheme of these models that someone else had. And so the colors, so what you're seeing is that the fact that everybody's to the left here is telling you that all these models suck compared to Higgs inflation. And how badly they suck on a log scale is along the bottom here. And the arrows, I can't remember, and this is taken from a talk that Jerome made, and I can't remember what he was highlighting with those arrows, but if you look, ask for the who does as well as or better than Higgs inflation, they never go far to the right, but there's some that go a little bit to the right, and it's hard for you to see them here, but there's a few here, there's a few here, there's a few up there, and then that's it, actually, basically.
So we really haven't talked about this last week, right? This
yeah. Brain inflation.
BI, I think
yeah, but the other ones are all. There's a theme. I'm going to argue now that there's a theme going on here, and that this is a quantitative way of telling you something, which is simple to say. I think. Oh, I forgot now. It's. Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
So to me, this kind of smells like, I mean, I'm not very familiar with this paper, but it just kind of smells like a quantitative exploration of your own bias. Choose a prior, and then the prior doesn't.
I'll show you. I think you're anticipating the next slide, I think, is what's happening. So I can show you why the models that, what distinguishes a model that sucks from a model that doesn't suck here. So they take the range of parameters, like you said, and they track what happens as you vary the parameters through some range, and it's decided to be it's uniform or log. But there's some range of parameters that they like to track. And so here's, in colors, a variety of different models here. And so if you focus on, say, this one, depending on how they set up the parameters, they'll get predictions anywhere in that stripe. And what you're punished for in the way they're doing this analysis is that if you're taken by any of these parameters away from this oval, then you'll be punished. And the ones that an example of one of the ones that did well was the blue model here, ESI, which was always in this stripe. And so the question is, what is that saying, and why is it interesting? Is it useful? And I want to I have a take on that. And so what I want to argue is that the models that are being preferred here, those are models for which there's been progress been made on the eta problem. The eta problem is the question in inflation. You've got a potential, and you're asking for those two slow roll parameters to be small. And they were derivatives of the potential. And if someone gives you some random potential, like 5^4, the way you make them small is you adjust the parameters in your potential against one another so that you get a small derivative. And so if you had to do that, then as you vary the parameters, you'll see that you're not always getting them to be small. And then you start to leave the region where you're doing nice things. The models that are being preferred in this kind of analysis are ones for which you go through all the parameters and they're always small, so that you've actually made progress on the eta problem, and that the slow rollness is a generic feature of your potential. And that's one less thing to tune if you're in the business of finding problems with tuning. So how might that have happened? Well, you'll see that there's a theme to those models that are being predicted. They tend to be exponential potentials. So what's going on is simple. If you have an exponential potential like this, then those potentials, the slow roll parameters, remember, one was the first derivative squared, the other one was the second derivative. You're picking up the exponential, essentially, in the derivative. And all the derivatives are the same size of the potential. And so it's sufficient for the field to be large to make these slow roll parameters small, period. For any value of the parameters in your Lagrangian, like V naught or K, all you have to do is be in the part of field space where phi was large, and you're done. as far as the slow roll story is going. And that's why these models love to live in this place, the sweet spot. That's part of why they like to live in the sweet spot. The second reason they like to live in the sweet spot, you remember, favored small r. And you can kind of see why they favor, ooh. And then the drugs took effect, sorry. Now you're going to see everything I was going to tell you. So what you can see the reason these guys favor small r is that because epsilon was the square of the first derivative, and this is linear in the second derivative, and all those derivatives are the same size, you're always getting something of order, epsilon is of the order of eta squared. And it turns out that this r, the ratio of the scalar to tensor to scalar ratio, scalar tensor to scalar ratio, is controlled purely by eta, whereas the tilt is controlled by epsilon and eta. So if epsilon is small, it's being controlled by eta. So you're generically getting a prediction for r that's of the order of ns minus 1 squared. And ns is of the order of 0.96, so this is like 0.04 squared. And so you're getting r, which is small on that scale I showed you, but it's not so small it's not worth looking and not worth trying to see. So it's kind of interestingly small. And those are the models I claim that the data likes. And the reason I'm beating you on this is that those are the models that were proposed in 2001 by a class of people for whom B you'll recognize. And so I gave you the archive number conveniently there so you could, even though I didn't give you the names, so you could track that one down. And so basically the observation is that exponential potentials are, they at least deal with the eta problem, and that the largeness of the field is sufficient to make them slow roll.
What are the long-term high-tuning problems? Just a lambda function, you get delta 2 over 2, 10 to the minus 5.
Right.
Lambda has to be 10 to the minus 12.
Right.
Very unnatural.
Right.
What happens if that's
the... That's the eta problem. That's the one I've been talking about.
So this is the eta problem.
Right. Because that's the question of those numbers are being set by the value of epsilon and eta. So you're doing the tuning in the parameters to make these numbers small. But I'm claiming in this model, you don't have that problem. If phi is large, you don't have that specific problem. You have other problems, like the initial condition problem might still be there. You have to start at the right place in the potential. I'm not saying these are problem-free models, but they have one less of the problems that the other models have, I would claim. All right, so that's nice. So now what about... You know, people were asking about the Higgs inflation model. Can you get that from, can you get that from ultraviolet physics? You could ask the same thing about these models. Is this the kind of thing that's very contrived? Or is this the kind of thing that is in your face if you go to higher energies? And I want to argue that it's in your face, that there's a broad class of ultraviolet physics that will give you these models. So they smell good from a lot of ways. They smell good because the data likes them, and they smell good because ultraviolet physics, which will ultimately be required to address the conceptual issues, also like them. So how does that work? So here I'm going to be concrete. I'm going to be specifically talking about string inflation, because that's the one place where the quantum gravity is sufficiently fleshed out that you can actually nail and ask the inflationary issues in a very clean way. And it was only possible to do this. It was clear that since the 80s that if you have a theory of quantum gravity, you'd love to do inflation in it, because that's the one place where you're testing things at very high energies. But progress really started just after 2000, because that's when it became possible to quantify the question properly. Because the essence of the problem is you've got a scalar potential, and it's not sufficient to find one field and get a shallow potential for that field. You normally have a lot of fields in these problems. And you don't care if one direction in field space is very shallow if perpendicular direction is really steep, because you're going to go the steep direction. So you needed to be able to understand what the entire potential was in order to ask if the shallow direction you're finding is the most steep direction. That's the hard part of the problem. And that became possible right around 2001 because of developments of how to stabilize extra dimensions. And the thing that you normally come into when you ask about inflation, so you can go through the exercise, but what are you hoping to learn? You can get anything out of string theory, so you can get any inflation out of string theory. And I want to argue for you that that's actually not been what's transpired. It's been more than 10 years, or it's been about 10 years since the early papers. And so you could ask, so have there been any predictions? And the claim I'm going to make is that they do two things. They generally favor small r, not always because of exponential potentials, but they also very generally have exponential potentials in them. So what I'd like to do is take the models that were predicted before Planck. And so to prove to you that I'm doing that, I'm going to take this from a talk by Polchinski in 2008, which is well before Planck, but it was not before WMAP. So what he was doing here was he's plotting the WMAP analog of that NS versus R plot. And these are the various models that the WMAP people were looking at. But the colored ones were ones that Polchinski added. He was doing the summary talk in this meeting, and the people in the meeting were talking about various string inflation models. These were the people. These were not the people, but one of them was talking of those people. And this is where those various models were on that plot when Joe plotted it. So if I just move those points to the Planck plot, this is where they are. These are the same points. It looks like these ones are farther apart, and they are, because he had put them here. He just got that one wrong. So, and I know that because that's our model, so I kind of know where it's supposed to be. And it's, you know, we thought it was a bad thing, because the thing that you get from this is that all these models have R no bigger than 0.05 or something. Why weren't there any models up here? This is kind of where the simple phi squared models are, say. And so the reason is, it seems to be that it's difficult to make a model which predicts a large value of R, for reasons I'll get to in a second. And so that observation had been made before 2008, and so people were trying hard to tweak the models to make R as large as possible, and these were the ones that emerged. And at the time, we didn't like the fact we were so low, because they were better at it, making R large than we were. And so this is the monodromy inflation model that you've probably heard about, where that's the world record largest value for R that has been achieved. And what you get from this plot is that when you worked as hard as you could to make it as big as possible, you still had trouble being in trouble with the data. It's something, and that's not true for generic single field models. Most of the popular single field models are already up there and excluded. And so that's a feature that seems to be common to the models that have been found. It's not a theorem, but it's just like an experimental fact given the searches that have been done. No, actually, it was the opposite. When people were making these models, people were trying to make it as large as possible to see if there was an interesting constraint you could make in parameter space. People were interested in the. The question was, let me say what the life bound is, and I'll come back to that. So, what's the life bound? So, here's the life bound. The observation in single field models that Life made was that there's a relationship between the distance you travel in field space and the value of R. Because they're related, because R is being controlled by this first slow roll parameter, and at the shallower your potential is, you know, the farther the steepness of your potential controls how far you roll in a given amount of time, and the given amount of time is set by the E foldings of inflation. And it's not really a tight thing. You can evade this bound if you work at it, because you're really only measuring the derivatives kind of at horizon exit, where the modes that we see now were leaving the horizon during inflation, and you can kind of start engineering funny things after that, which wouldn't have been visible in cosmology, and which could change how far delta phi goes. But it's true that most of these models, and in particular the ones I'm talking about from the string cosmologies, don't take advantage of that way of evading the bound. And so the question was, the observation was that to have R be large enough to be observed, it seemed like you had to go trans-Planckian distances in field space. And one question was, does that make sense? Since we're working at low energies. So this is an example of a question where you need the ultraviolet completion to really answer that. The first part of the statement is that it's not necessarily crazy to think at low energies that fields could be going through trans-Planckian ranges if it's true that there's potential is shallow enough. Because what counts, what justifies the low energy approximation is the energy available to you. And so if your fields don't give you much energy as they get very large, then you're allowed to have them be large. There's nothing in principle wrong with that. But it doesn't tell you in practice whether it made sense from the point of view of the ultraviolet completion. But in string theory, you can ask that question, because phi is going to turn into some geometrical thing. It's the position of a brain, or it's the size of some extra dimension. And you can ask, what was the allowed range it had? And the bottom line seems to have been the reason that these models prefer small r is that it seems to be that when you make a model, it's hard to get the phi to go through a trans-Planckian range. And so, for example, if your inflaton is the distance between two brains, the criterion that phi be bigger than the Planck scale turns out to be the criterion that the motion of the brain is larger than the size of the extra dimension it's moving in. So there's some geometrical constraint like that stops it. That's not always the what happens, but it seems like there's always something that comes in and stops you going too far. So here's an example of the utility of an ultraviolet completion. It allows you to ask those questions in a crisp way. And there seems to be emerging a statement. It's not a theorem, but it's a preference for a small r. And when people were making these models, they were trying to see how big could you make r be. And it was if it was inconsistent with WMAP, so much the better, because now there's actually experimental information about string theory. That was So there was no bias to have R small enough that you would, that it would evade the bound. And it's just hard to do. It's just that's not to say it's impossible, but it's just in the way people are looking, it's hard to do now. Okay. Now what about exponential potentials? In about half these models, the inflaton is the motion, is the distance between brains, let's say. In the other half, the inflaton is the size of an extra dimension. Say it's the radius of some cycle in the extra dimensions. And the case I want to make now is that whenever it's the second one, the size of something, you generically get exponential potentials. And it's for a simple reason. And that's because if you're doing something like string theory or some quantum gravity theory, it's typically hard to calculate in general. But the way you get to calculate is if you're in the low energy limit. So if you're talking about curvatures that are small compared to the gravity scale, then you can talk about things in an effective field theory. And that's essentially how most of the things are learned about in string theory. So the domain of validity of the whole calculation in a string context or in any quantum gravity constant is usually the limit where the radius of interest to you is large compared to the basic scale of the problem. And so in that limit, it tends to be that the energies come to you as a curvature expansion because the curvature is small. And so you get things coming to you as a series in 1 over the radius. So you get potentials that are coming in like this, like 1 over radius to some power. And so why is that exponential? It's exponential because if you dimensionally reduce the Einstein action in higher dimensions and ask what's the kinetic energy for a radius, it comes in as the derivative of the radius squared divided by the radius squared. That's what the curvature turns into. So the canonical field here is the log of the radius. And when you use the slow roll formulas that I was using, the assumption is that the kinetic term is d phi d phi and not something more complicated. So it was necessary to go to the canonical field e to the phi. You like large phi. And that corresponds to large R. So the region where these potentials are flat is precisely the region where you believe the calculation of the potential. That's where the radius was large compared to the fundamental scale in the problem. So it's a very generic thing that you're going to get exponentials in potentials for variables like radii or sizes of things in the extra dimensions. The thing that's hard to get in these models is the one. The constant term is tricky to get, but it's not impossible to get. And so the models that are up there are the ones that engineered the constant, and you just have a lot of moduli. You hang a bunch of them, except for one, up in some place in the potential, which is positive and approximately constant along a trough, and that's how you get the constant. But the message is that this exponential form is a generic form for anything which is describing the shape of something at higher energies, and the good news is that that's the thing. It loves to be at large values of the fields, because that's where you can calculate it, and the data loves it to be large values of the fields, because that's where the potential is flat. There's the non-Gaussianity story, which I put in for completeness. The message of Planck was things are simple, and in particular, there's no non-Gaussianity. String inflation can give you non-Gaussianity. It doesn't have to give you non-Gaussianity. Brain inflation famously did give you non-Gaussianity if you're in a warped throat. And so we know that if that's what's describing inflation, it's not in a warped throat or not a strongly warped throat. Generically, you've got multiple fields. And although it's true that there's always a naturalness problem, how do you get any fields to be as light as the Hubble scale, which is what you need to get inflation to happen? To get anything to roll around during cosmology, the mass of something needs to be lighter than the Hubble scale. But in string theory, what typically happens in these models is that if you make one that light, if you contrive somehow to make one light, then you drag down maybe two or three of them. So it's not unusual to get a multiple field model where there's several fields that are at the Hubble scale or less. And so that's the kind of thing that could give you non-Gaussianity. And if you go through the exercise of looking for it, you can find it, but it's not generically there. What typically happens is, what counts is whether or not your trajectory in field space is a target space geodesic at the moment of horizon exit. And the generic situation is that it is. That unless you do something dramatic at a special time, you find that what you're getting is approximately, it's effectively described by a single field model. And this is an example of that. If you take the two curves here that you can have a hard time distinguishing, one of them was an honest to God integration of a multiple field theory that you got from these inflation models. And the other one is an effective single field description of it. And it just, they're indistinguishable because of this fact that you're not normally doing anything interesting at horizon exit. But if you had found non-Gaussianity, then there are examples here to be pointed at as what would give you non-Gaussianity. So the absence of evidence for complexity in Planck, I would argue, it's an interesting piece of information, but it's not necessarily evidence for absence of complexity. Did I say that right? Yeah, absence of evidence for complexity is not the evidence for absence of complexity. So the bottom line is UV complete inflation seems to give you small r, and it likes to give you exponential potentials. The data loves exponential potentials. That's in the literature, that's normally sold to you as a Sterbinsky type of potential, although that's, again, a model that's difficult to get from higher energies. But you can rewrite Sterbinsky as an exponential potential, and that more general class of things is the kind of thing that higher energy physics loves to give, and in particular, geometrical moduli of higher dimensions love to give you the kinds of things that are exponential, and exponentials the data loves because they don't have this eta problem. So they for all values of the parameters, they love to be in the sweet spot where Planck likes to put them. Okay, yeah.
So the thing that distinguishes, data that distinguishes various models that people want, it's part of the ratio.
That's one of the two things, yeah. Right.
So what if we try to measure compared to the levels? There are some models that take R as zero.
Yep.
Then
it sucks. It sucks to be you. No, I agree. It sucks to be me. If I have a model, I have models like that too. I think cosmology is like neutrino physics. You know, that you're doing experiments that are testing some aspects of what's going on, but you're not seeing in great detail like a collider would see what's going on. So there will be models which will be very difficult. They will not be present in what you measure. And there'll be other models that will be present. And the interesting ones are the ones that are close to what's measurable, because then you learn something about them. But there's nothing compelling about, in the absence of something compelling that says that those models are the required ones, it's a bit of a gambler's choice as to which ones nature will choose. So you hope to get lucky is what you hope, right? The experimentalists, the observation people, they're gods, I agree. So the issue is that, like neutrino physics, you look for things. If you find it, it's really informative. If you don't find it, it doesn't necessarily kill things. It might kill some things, but it won't necessarily kill most things. And that's just the way we are. That's where we are at this point in science. So that's life. All right, what about now? Cosmological concept problem. I work towards the end. I'll be telegraphic. There's two pieces here. I'm going to remind you what the idea is if you don't know what it is already. I'm assuming you've read all our papers, so you know exactly what we're talking about. But just in case there's a couple of people out there, I'll tell you what the idea is. And then I'll tell you the new thing, which is a paper which is built around Matt Williams' work. And the observation there is it identifies the symmetry mechanism that's responsible for this model doing as well as it's doing. And what's interesting about it on its own right is that it's something which people have been looking for 20 years. It's a way in which supersymmetry breaks. I can tell you in telegraphically. These systems are examples of models where there's extra dimensions, and the extra dimensions, at any one point in the extra dimensions, supersymmetry is not broken. It's only when you look at the whole extra dimensions as a whole that you see that the boundary conditions that you require are excluding supersymmetry. And so that means that anything that was forbidden by supersymmetry can't be generated by a very short wavelength mode that's much smaller than the extra dimensions, because it doesn't know yet that supersymmetry broke. It's a very local thing. It's only once you've integrated modes that are big enough to see the whole space that they see that supersymmetry broke. And because of that, they see that things that were forbidden, like vacuum energies by supersymmetry, are allowed to be non-zero. And that means that things are suppressed by the Kaluza-Klein scale in an unusual way. And that can happen even if the scales on localized physics, like on brains, is much higher than the Kaluza-Klein scale. So it's the kind of thing that you're looking for in the cosmological constant problem. And it's kind of interesting in its own right that there are suppressions that are controlled by the size of the extra dimensions, even though you naively would have had contributions that were large coming from physics localized in your space. And so, that depends on you'll see that it's a very general thing I'm describing. So it's in the concrete example I've got, it's going to be a sphere. And so maybe if you ask a question, then you'll be. You're asking I'm going to give you a prediction for the observed dark energy density as a function of the size of the extra dimensions, because it's going to be controlled by the Kaluza-Klein scale. And so because of that, the size of the extra dimensions is going to have to take a specific value, and it's going to turn out to be a micron or so. And so the whole the appeal of these models is going to be that if they're right, a whole bunch of things have to happen. And so, for example, you have to see deviations from Newton's law at that scale. And that, so that's how we'll know if it's right or wrong. And the message is really that the cosmological constant problem is telling you there's something you don't understand at low energies. And so it's stuff that you have access to in many ways. And in this case, it's the extra dimensions are the thing that's at low energies, changing how you think things gravitate. But it will be true that it makes it very rigid, that you can't start dialing the radius around to evade bounds, because the cosmological constant that you're measuring is being controlled by that radius. So you're stuck with this value that you're given in a way that I'll show you quantitatively in a second. So what's the idea? What's the problem first? The cosmological constant problem says that there's two things that we think should be the same, which seem to be different. One of those things is the energy density of a Lorentz invariant vacuum. We believe the vacuum is Lorentz invariant. There's lots of good evidence for that. And we think that every particle, and a weakly interacting particle in the vacuum, would contribute of order mass to the fourth to the energy density. And because it's Lorentz invariant, the stress energy will be proportional to the metric. So it's kind of a very, it is a cosmological constant. It's not some other complicated stress energy. And people might have argued that maybe it should have been bigger than this. Maybe it should be the Planck scale. And I think there's a discussion we could have there. But I think that that the robust thing, at the very least, you could think I'm being pessimistic as to what the problem is. I'm making it, I'm giving myself a lot of space. And this is still a hard problem. If I take the electron and I put in the electron mass here, you get something which is 10 to the 30 odd times too big compared to what's been seen in cosmology. So the problem, I would argue, is a low energy problem, that the electron is the problem. Now, so that's the vacuum energy, but you don't actually measure the vacuum energy. What you measure in cosmology is the curvature, because you're seeing the universe accelerate in its expansion. And the problem is that Einstein tells you that they're the same thing, that Einstein says that the, you know, t mu nu is t mu nu. It's such a simple t mu nu that it's just the right-hand side is an obstruction to small curvature, and you're measuring small curvature. The biggest you could afford to have this right-hand side be thought of as an m to the fourth would be 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the fourth power. And every mass we know of in nature is huge compared to that, except possibly for neutrinos. That's the problem. But the way I've been laboring the Lorentz invariance, because that's an important part of the problem, and it's something which, as soon as you have more than four dimensions, you can see that there's a loophole in which you can try and find a solution to the cosmological constant problem, because you have a way to decouple vacuum energy that's Lorentz invariant in the four-dimensional sense from curvature, which is measured in the four dimensions that are Lorentz invariant. So the simplest example, the message will be, the simplest example of the loophole would be if you asked the question of what is in general relativity the gravitational field of a line distribution of mass, a cosmic string. That's something which along the world sheet of the string is a Lorentz invariant matter distribution. So it's like a cosmologic constant in two dimensions. But you can ask, in that case, you can just solve the Einstein equations and ask what the curvature is. And the answer is that it's flat for any value of the tension of the string, so for any value of the energy density. That's the kind of thing we're looking for the cosmological constant, something which is small curvature for any value of the vacuum energy. So what happens in the solution for a cosmic string, if this is the string and this is a slab-o space-time, then what happens is that the geometry of the geometry not just on the string is flat, it's the geometry everywhere is flat except for at the string's position. It's a cone geometrically, and so if you took a slab of space-time out and you identified the edges, you'd have a conical singularity here. And the way you'd see that light, so there'd be no tidal forces because everything's flat out here, but the way you see that light bends around the string is that this light ray goes straight, this light ray hits this thing, and then it has to come in at the same angle because they've been identified, and so then they've effectively focused as they went by the string. And so that's the gravitational field of a string. And that's the kind of thing that if we'd been a two-dimensional person living on that string, we would have said, we've got a huge vacuum energy, a lot of quantum corrections to it, but we don't care because it's got nothing to do with the curvature that we see. So the idea is to do that in two higher dimensions, and you can. There are solutions where you have, so you can take general relativity in six dimensions, and you can look for solutions with a four-dimensional string-like thing. And you can find examples where the energy on the string curves something, but it just doesn't curve the directions that are on the string. So the examples, the simplest examples, but not the only examples, are spheres where you have a brain located at the north and south pole, and you can remove, if you imagine cutting out wedges along two lines of longitude and gluing them together, that will give you conical singularities there. So you curve something, but what you curve was the transverse curvature, not the on-brain geometries. If you solve the field equations, you find they can be flat. But that's not in itself a solution to the cosmological constant problem, in a way I'll get to in a second. But it's a place where you can look for a solution. So if you ask in equations what was important about why did that work, if you ask what is the cosmological constant in a thing like this, it turns out that the curvature, the cosmological constant in four dimensions has two pieces to it. One piece is the energy on the strings. So if you just the tensions on the string, they just directly contribute as a vacuum energy. But the second piece comes from integrating out the physics of the bulk. So all the higher Kaluza-Klein modes, you're supposed to solve at the classical level, you're supposed to solve them as functions of the light fields and put that back into the action. And that's their contribution to the low energy four-dimensional world. So there's some action here evaluated at the solution of the field equations. Now it's a theorem that the conical singularity story says that the curvature, I would find the curvature scalar of the extra dimensions has a delta function contribution to it. That's the conical singularity. And the normalization of that is set by Einstein's equations in terms of the tension. And then there's a smooth piece describing the sphere here. And there's other fields if you're doing a supergravity, let's say. Now what happens if you plug all that stuff in the action generically is the interesting thing is that the delta function gets done by the integral here. And then the coefficients are such that this thing cancels this thing. So the tension is dropping out of the answer. That's why you're getting things that are flat for any value of the tension. Generically, the rest of the action is not zero, but it can be zero depending on the field theory you choose. And in particular, for supergravity theories, it's generically zero because of the scale invariance of supergravity in higher dimensions. And in particular, if I had chosen the supergravity I'm going to show you in a second, it's an exact statement that this right-hand side turns out to be a total derivative. And so it's something which is controlled only by the near brain behavior of the fields in the bulk. And that, so there's something, this is actually true for all supergravities, that it turns out that the curvature on brains is a very local property in supergravity at a classical level. So remember that fact, that if you have a particular field in the extra dimensions in a supergravity, which has zero derivative, normal to the brain, at the brain, that's a sufficient condition for the geometry to be flat on the brains. And so there's a story there which is an interesting story in its own, but let me just skip that. So that's not a solution to the cosmologic constant problem. That shows you that there are solutions that are flat. But what you have to ask for the cosmologic constant problem is there will be other solutions that are not flat. And you have to ask, what choices do I have to make to get a flat solution? And then I have to ask, are those choices stable under integrating out short wavelength modes? And that's the cosmologic constant problem re-asked in this context. And so there's a long song and dance I can tell you the answer about. And the answer is that generically, higher dimensions in themselves do not solve that problem. Generically, if you do loops in the higher dimensions, you get vacuum energies that are not small. But if you have supersymmetry in the extra dimensions, then the scale invariance that comes with that, classically, together with the supersymmetry, does give you progress on the cosmologic constant problem in the sense that the natural scale for the vacuum energy turns out to be the Kaluza-Klein scale for the reason there's the symmetry reason I'm about to give you. So if you ask kind of why is it that quantum effects are not affecting the cosmologic constant in these models, there's two ingredients that I want you to remember. The first thing is, if I have big particles, all the particles we know about in nature that are the problem are living on a brain, on the brains, and they're not supersymmetric at all in this picture. I talk about supersymmetry, it's just in the bulk, not on the brains. So it's a standard model in the brains and no MSSM. If you ask why didn't they give you a cosmologic constant, the reason is that they're essentially integrating them out as giving you a change to the tension, but the tension was irrelevant for the cosmologic constant, for the curvature of the brain. And in particular, it was sufficient for there not to be a coupling between a bulk field and the brain to get a flat solution. That was a sufficient condition for flatness. That's the kind of condition that likes to be stable under loops on the brain. Because if you don't start with a coupling to phi, you won't generate couplings to phi using only those interactions that didn't start with a coupling to phi. The thing that will be dangerous will be a loop of, say, a graviton in the extra dimensions, because the brain couples to the metric couples to phi, and then that'll give you a coupling to phi for the brain. But you're immediately being protected from the particles we know exist, the particles in the standard model that are on the brain, that are not supersymmetric. You're forced to go to the bulk, but bulk is where supersymmetry lives, in the picture I'm describing. And the supersymmetry is then going to help you in the way that I alluded to at the very beginning. So the picture that you should be thinking about phenomenologically is that particle physics is just ordinary standard model, no supersymmetry, but gravity is very supersymmetric. And when it comes time to do cosmology, that's the world you want to be living in. So the last thought is, what's the symmetry mechanism? So the symmetry mechanism is the one I alluded to. I want to flesh it out just a little bit. There's two parts to it, which I'll explain. But the utility of having a symmetry mechanism is twofold. Once you've got rid of all the ultraviolet sensitive pieces, everybody's giving you the same size contribution to the vacuum energy. And so in particular, states that are above the string scale, say if this is a string theory, should be competing with states that are below the string scale. And you'd like to know, that means, so they could be important. They could be competing with the stuff that the low energy physics is giving you. And if you don't really robustly know how small the answer is unless you have some sort of a symmetry reason for understanding the small parameters that are in that answer. So that's one thing that a symmetry tells you. It gives you some idea of whether it's plausible that the mechanism could work in string theory or whatever your theory of quantum gravity is that you like. Second thing is it gives you an estimate of the size. And so I'm going to argue that this supersymmetry breaking globally but not locally forces the answer to look like, you can design examples which don't look like this, but there exist examples that look like this. There's the Klutze-Klein power to the fourth power, the Klutze-Klein scale to the fourth power. That's this radius that Ghazal was asking about. There's two powers of 4 pi at least, because it's a loop in the extra dimensions. And there's a number, which is order 1, coming from the various fields in the problem. It could be order 1,000,000. It could be order 1,000. It's some number that has to be pinned down, but it's something which is not parametrically depending on the small parameters. And then there's a thing which measures the scale of supersymmetry breaking in the problem. And in particular, that turns out to depend in this configuration of brains on the difference of tensions between the brains compared to the gravity scale in the extra dimensions. And so even if you started with those things being equal, that's the kind of thing that quantum effects can change. If I have two brains that are identical and I have a standard model on this brain, loops of it will change its tension and make the tensions different. So this cannot be smaller than the masses of the particles that I know about, like the top quark, say that's the heaviest particle we know about, with the appropriate 4 pi for a loop. So that's a lower bound for what this could be. But when I put these things together, this is the prediction. You've got something involving a particle physics scale, the extra dimensional gravity scale, the Planck scale, 4 pi's, and some number up front. This number, if I use the top quark and the smallest value that the gravity scale could be in the extra dimensions as 10 TeV, this is 5 times 10 to the minus 5 electron volts to the fourth power. So if this number is 6,000,000, then you get exactly the answer you would expect for the vacuum energy you measure. And the thing that we don't know is what's this number, because it depends on summing all the various fields in the extra dimensions and in the bulk. But well, it will depend on that, but each species could depend differently on the on. Not all species are going to contribute the same value for k.
What order of would be?
Well, I can give you examples where k is say 500, for if I take a massive multiplet of low spin fields in the bulk, then that calculation we actually did, and that gives you k of about 500, 525 or so. There's a. Yeah, the whole six-dimensional fields in a six-dimensional supermultiplet. Yeah. So it depends on the mass of the particles in the supermultiplet, but it compares it to the gravity scale in the supermultiplet. And the calculation in the field theory, the largest that can be is of the same order, because once these masses are comparable to the gravity scale, then you really have to do that in the ultraviolet completion. So that's why it's going to be important to know if there's a symmetry mechanism to see if the same kind of physics is going to same kind of scales are going to arise in the ultraviolet completion. Weighted appropriately, right. Fermions and bosons generically are different signs. If you have a exactly supersymmetric configuration, then they would cancel, and then this would be zero. And that's kind of where this delta came from. So it's
so the vacuum density is less than 10 to the minus 3 electron volts.
It's 3 times 10 to the minus 4. 3 times 10 to the minus 3 to the fourth power is the number that's been measured. Right. So the main thing to get from here is that this is the first time, I think, there's been a serious calculation where the number is less than that. Normally what happens is you get something which is bigger than that, and then there has to be some cancellation going on to make the answer small enough. Here's an example where you can have 6,000,000 of these things, and they're not going to be, you don't need a particular cancellation going on beyond the supersymmetry that's in the problem. And that's amazing, right? That's the amazing thing. So you need to know what k is, but the amazing thing is that k doesn't have to be 10 to the minus 30 to get the right number. Essentially not, because I'm glad you asked that, but you might have thought that because things are supersymmetric in the bulk, that things would also have to be supersymmetric in the brain. And actually, let me come back to that, because that's point one here. So let me come back to the issue as to whether there's a relationship and re-ask it if it's not answered when I finish talking about this, because I'm past my time here. So the bottom line is this, that let's imagine we've got a bunch of particles with just a standard model on the brain. What we're interested in the vacuum energy, so we'll integrate them all out. And we're going to get some effective Lagrangian that tells us how the brain couples to the bulk because we've integrated out the on-brain fields. And I can organize that in a derivative expansion because I've got dimensions that are large compared to the gravity scale in the problem. So the no derivative term is a tension. There's a root g in front of everything here I haven't written. It turns out there's a one derivative term, which is these models I didn't tell you in detail about. In order to ask the question properly, you have to be able to stabilize the extra dimensions because you're asking what the vacuum energy is. And so the way these things are stabilized is this is a model that's based on something from the early 80s, and it's if you have a magnetic field in the extra dimensions that threads the sphere, then shrinking the sphere, because of flux quantization, shrinking the sphere costs energy, and then, so that's what stabilizes the extra dimensions. Now that magnetic field, it's dual in six dimensions, is a four form, and that could be integrated on the surface of a four-dimensional brain, and so that's something that has a coefficient in the Lagrangian, and that has a physical interpretation of being flux that's localized on this brain. If we've been talking about the cosmic string again, the same thing could have happened. A two-form in four dimensions dualizes to a two-form, and then this would have been the magnetic flux in that cosmic string. And so this is the higher dimensional analog of that. And then there's two derivative terms beyond that. The amazing thing is if you ask, what's the criterion for this brain not to break supersymmetry? The bulk has a supersymmetry, which is not broken under certain conditions, and it depends on what this field is. But it is possible to have it not be broken. The brain will not break supersymmetry if there's a relationship between these two coefficients. And this is the relationship where phi is this field that the brain is a combination of the field that the brain is not supposed to couple to and the metric. There's a flat direction in the problem, but it's a specific scalar field evaluated at the brain position. And so at this point, you might think, well, this is not surprising so far. It's commonplace to have brains that don't break supersymmetry, and if they have a charge and they have a mass, then if the charge and the mass are equal to each other in some units, that's a BPS condition, and then typically you can preserve half the supersymmetries that could have been there. And this is very much like that. This is a charge being equated to the mass. But the amazing thing is not that. The amazing thing is that this can be satisfied for any value of these two constants because it depends on a field which is not determined at all by the field equations. The field equations have a classical scale invariance, so there's a flat direction to them. This is the flat direction. So there's no field equation in the problem that tells you what this is. It's flux quantization that tells you what this is. And so that means that it's always possible to satisfy the classical equations and to satisfy supersymmetry for any value of these constants on the brain. But it may not be true, if you have several brains, that the same value can make things supersymmetric at all the brains. So you will break supersymmetry, but you won't know it until you've seen what all the brains were doing in the problem, or seeing that any one brain is consistent with flux quantization, which is also a global property. So because this was true for this Lagrangian was obtained by integrating out particles, and we didn't care if they're supersymmetric or not. This is the most general Lagrangian you could have had, and because it's supersymmetric for any value of the parameters, that's the magic. The scale of supersymmetry breaking in the brain could be huge. It could be a TV scale. There don't have to be any superpartners at all there. It could be just bosons. Doesn't matter. At low energies, there will accidentally be a supersymmetry if this is satisfied for any value of these coefficients. And if you do loops on the brains, you'll change these coefficients, but it doesn't matter because you don't care what those values are. So that's the essence of the mechanism. And that's why particle physics, the assumption that goes into the MSSM is that you might ask, how can supergravity couple to something not supersymmetric? And the way you couple supergravity to something not supersymmetric, like just bosons, is you nonlinearly realize supersymmetry in the bosonic. You can always choose the couplings of a Goldstone fermion to anything to make it globally supersymmetric. And then you can couple supergravity to that in the standard Noether prescription. So there's a way of coupling supergravity to this stuff, but you don't have to have superpartners for that. And the assumption that goes into the existence of the MSSM superpartners is that you take the electron, you do supersymmetry, you get this electron, because it's assumed that the superpartner is a single particle state. But in these theories, what would happen is that the variation of the electron is the electron plus the gravitino, or plus a Goldsteino, which gets eaten by the gravitino. So it's a boson, but it's a two-particle state. And so you would not expect to see any MSSM particles. And since I'm out of time, I'll just go to there's a bunch of problems, which I'll put up for later on. There's predictions, and I'll just, since we've talked about it, talk about the ones which were made before they were done, and I now check off as successes. There should not be finding the MSSM at the LHC. That was a prediction before the LHC. And the Higgs should be vanilla, because there's no evidence, it doesn't actually have to be vanilla, but it's given that the gravity scale is so low, and the standard model works so well, it's probably the standard model on the brain. So it would have been a surprise to find that there was room for a fancy Higgs there, so I like that answer too. So in these variety of cosmology and particle physics models or conferences where everyone's depressed, I'm the only smile in the room, because I think that these if there was more than one answer to the cosmologic constant problem, then we could debate which one was right. Nature may not care, but if nature cares about the cosmologic constant problem and there's one answer to it, then that's probably the way nature works. And it's very bizarre. You need supersymmetry and extra dimensions that are large, but it seems to work in the sense that it's not in conflict with anything we know, as far as we can tell. So I'll leave you with Conan Doyle, When you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. And so if that's true, if that's false, you'll all forget this. But if it's true, I'll remind you all personally that this was made and it's been recorded. So thank you for your time.